Listen, I want to thank everybody that's helped us open the meeting by reading. I take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. A warm welcome to any visitors with us tonight. I'm glad you're with us. Massive welcome to anyone who might be new to Narcotics Anonymous with us this evening. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. Okay, we do have a speaker tonight. They're going to share with us for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever they're comfortable with, their story, experience, strength, and hope, journey to, into, and through Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm going to hand you over to Helen, our wonderful share finder, to introduce them. So over to you, Helen.
Thank you, Steve. I'm Helen. I'm an addict, gratefully recovering.
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Meeting. Yeah, I'm so very happy to have asked this person to come and share with us. And I've got this mind, this thing in my head saying, yeah, but what introduction are you going to be able to give to this person? It seemed like I'm only bringing all these wonderful people to come and share their experience, strength, and hope. And this person, is again such a, but maybe even more, it's like such an important person in my recovery from the very beginning of my stumbling into NA meetings and reaching out desperately, quite quickly, I think. Found it easy to reach out, and this person always has such a strong recovery to share, and such it's like the his ability to hold space for recovery is so huge. And I know that we speak mostly with our sponsors, but I'm thinking of this person, maybe I have a sponsor, and then I've got godmothers and godfathers in recovery. Well, this person is definitely a godfather in my recovery, and I'm so looking forward to hearing more about his story, about his because when I hear him share on a daily basis on 3 4 minutes, there's so much recovery in those 3 4 minutes that I'm really very anyway, with no further ado, Stevie B, come and share with us your experience, strength, and hope. Thank you so much.
Thank
Hello.
you, Ellen. No pressure. My name is Stephen. I'm a very grateful recovering addict. Thank you, Ellen, for that.
Hi, Stevie.
Hi,
Welcome.
Steve.
Super grateful to be here tonight. Thank you, Ellen, for asking me to share. Thank you for the group servants in this meeting. I'm grateful to be clean tonight. Just straight off the bat, just so you know, I'm like 7 years and like tomorrow, I think I'm 7 years, 5 months tomorrow. So that's nice. I'm dialing in from Rome. I'm from the UK, from the northwest in the UK. It's where I did most of my using and where I got my recovery. And I now, during like term time, I study in Rome, doing something like completely different with my life. And I get to do that, and I get to be on this journey. I get to live and breathe. I get to everything I have in my life today, my family, my friends, and a fellowship I have. The beautiful people in recovery that I know, the peace that I have in my heart, the improvements in my health, the improvements in my mood, and the level of acceptance that I have of myself. Everything I have, everything in my life, everything is a result of Narcotics Anonymous in this 12-step program. And there is nothing that I have in my life today that is not a result of that. Nothing. Everything comes from that. And that's why I keep coming back. Because I don't want to lose it. I don't want to lose what I've got. at the beginning of the meeting, Steve had invited us to just have a few moments silence for the addict that still suffers. And I really felt that tonight, and I really connected with it. I don't always, when in that, at that moment in a meeting, when you have a moment of silence, sometimes I might just not even notice it. But I noticed it tonight, and I felt it tonight, and I engaged with it tonight, and I did pause and I did stop. And I was thinking about the people that will die of this disease tonight. The people here in Rome that will die of this disease tonight. The people in the UK, in Lancaster, where I got my recovery, in Manchester, where I'm from, across the whole of the Northwest, where I did a lot of using and I'm thinking of the families that will be ruined tonight and the heartache that will be caused because addicts die tonight and the suffering and the sadness that will occur because addicts will die needlessly of this disease tonight. And I can't fix that. I can't, I'm powerless. You guys have taught me that I'm powerless over my addiction, and I'm certainly powerless over everyone else's. But what I can do, the bit that I can do, is here tonight in this meeting with you beautiful people, you beautiful, beautiful recovering addicts. I can share my experience and I can carry a message. And I'm really grateful for that opportunity. I'm really grateful for that opportunity. Gosh, I'm really feeling this now. I'm really connecting with a sense of gratitude for this program and you guys. Now, if I had the ability to restore myself to sanity, if I had that ability, I would have done it a long time ago. I'm 51 years old, but we came into recovery when I was 44, and I used for a long time. I used for 20. I picked up when I was 16. But truthfully, even before that, I was kind of like, I look back and I have such like compassion. I call him Little Stephen, Little Stephen, like that little lad. And his childhood was unhappy, and now none of that stuff makes me an addict. None of it. I'm an addict because I've got an illness. And the stuff that happened in my childhood and growing up didn't cause that illness. The way I look at it, though, is it's like those wounds that were caused in my childhood, like the disease, like festered and spread in them. Like they were, like they became like a fertile place for the disease to kind of like spread. So the violence in my childhood, the bullying at school, like school was like really unhappy, primary school and secondary school. Another stuff that kind of really impacted me negatively and kept me in a really frightened, really fearful, really disconnected place for right up until the age of 16. None of that explains why I'm an addict, but it kind of does explain why the disease of addiction really took hold of me and kind of like and proliferated in me. And I remember when I first picked up at 16, like as I say, like school was unhappy. I don't really want to go into details because not because I'm unwilling to share it, but because I want to share the solution. Do you know what I mean? And I sometimes hear addicts say, oh, in meetings they go, I'll just qualify myself as an addict. And I'm like, listen, I'm in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I don't need to freaking qualify myself. I'm here. I'm in an NA meeting. Like, what more evidence do you need? Like, I'm here. I'm an addict. But all you really need to know is that when I was 16, I already hated myself by that point. I already was like really like afraid, was really like an anxious, nervous kid, like apologizing for who I was. No confidence, deeply insecure, deeply unhappy. And then I picked up at 16, and my whole world was turned upside down. And I picked up, I went to, so I left school and I went to this sixth form college. And so it was like different people, it's like a new, you know, there's different people. And straight away, and this is like Manchester, 1989 in Manchester. And for anything, any of you that know anything about kind of like cultural history or were around at that time, you know, that was like Manchester was the place to be in 1989. You know, you're talking Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, 808 State, dance music, the Hacienda, Conspiracy. It was like, it was so exciting. And I just kind of like, I went to college and everyone just used, like, that's what everyone was doing. Everyone was smoking dope, everyone was taking E's. It was like everyone was like super excited about what was going on. And it was just, that's just what you did. Like, that's just what you did. There was no kind of like, there was not one part of me that thought like, oh, should I not be doing this? In fact, the opposite. In fact, I can remember being at secondary school. And you know that you have like talks and like drug awareness stuff and people come in. And I remember we had like one of those talks or, and like my reaction was, that sounds amazing. Like, I can't really can't wait till I can try that. You know, that's like, so that's how I kind of know I'm an addict. Like, it's always been attractive to me. Even before I picked up, like, drugs was attractive to me. Yeah, I picked up at 16, and all that anxiety, all that fear, all that kind of like nervousness and not fitting in just disappeared. And overnight, I would literally, it was like a switch went on, and I was lit up like a Christmas tree. And I became confident, outgoing, life and soul of the party. And there was a couple of years, like when I was 16, 17, 18, where it was just like, it was really exciting. We were going out, we were going to raves, we were jumping in cars, going on motorways, going to clubs, going to warehouse parties. And I was playing in bands. I never really share about this stuff, but I guess I have a bit longer to share tonight, so I'll share about it. So, and I started like playing in bands and loving it. And and that feeling of being on stage, you know, being high and being on stage and like everyone dancing, and I just freaking loved it, man. Like, there was nothing like that in the world. It was looking out when you're on stage and seeing a whole bunch of people dancing and getting into the music. We did kind of like dance music and electronic stuff, and this was right at the beginning of like house music, and it was so exciting. Like, we felt like we were kings of the world. Like, we felt, honestly, it felt like that our drugs and our music, we were going to change the world. I genuinely believe that. I believe that, like, through ecstasy and cannabis and amphetamines and dance music. It sounds so crazy now, but I genuinely believe this. I thought, we're going to change the world. Everyone else, like, look at all those suckers working. Look at all those suckers, you know. Look at all those suckers, like, doing 9 to 5 jobs. Like, we've got the real truth here, you know, peace and love. You know, I was really chasing that kind of hippie kind of like ideal, that flower power hippie. Like, I bought into it hook, line, and sinker, and I genuinely believed it. And I used to think, well, you know what? Those guys got it wrong in the 60s, but we're going to show them how to do it. You know, we're going to have a peace and love revolution. And for a few years, it felt like that could kind of happen, until it kind of stopped being fun. You know, it kind of stopped being fun. The clubs got a bit more violent. You know, in Manchester, there was lots of guns around, and like crack and coke started coming in, and the whole like, kind of loving, kind of loved up, kind of Manchester kind of vibe, kind of soured and became edgy and a bit frightening and a bit dangerous. And the people that I kind of used with and went out clubbing with and all that stuff, they kind of stopped, and they grew up and they kind of got jobs and went to uni and did a whole bunch of stuff, you know, got married, had children. But I stayed in this place. I just stayed in this place. I just carried on using. It become, by that point, the drugs had a grip on me. I was using every day. Very quickly, I was using every day, and I thought, I'm still going to do it. I'm going to work in the music industry. Blah 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 blah, and I had some success. I had some success in the music industry. I did. I was on a TV show. I did the keyboards in the house band on this TV show, and everyone was like, "Oh wow, yeah, Stevie, you've made it." I was like, really, I was like 19, I think, or 20, and I thought I had. There was this. I was doing like the did the first series of the show, and I started. The guys I was working with, these are famous guys in Manchester, big hitters, and they were asking me to work on this album, and we're planning a world tour. And I had the keys to the studio, and I was like recording and doing these remixes for them, and it was everything. Everyone was like, "Wow, Stevie, you've made it!" Like, and I was so unhappy. And the fact of the matter is, I was using so much at that point that I started stealing from the studio, like to kind of fund my addiction. And like my friends would come around and they would just take stuff from the studio, and I would kind of just like, oh, they would just like take CDs and things, and I was like such a people pleaser and such an approver. I like didn't stop them. And eventually, they kind of said, "Listen, we need the keys back, Stevie, in the studio." So I gave them the keys, but I knew that they'd rumbled me, and they knew that something was going on. And they carried on, and they did the world tour, and they released the singles, and I was like just left like with this like, and everyone was like, "Hey, Steve, I thought you were doing that thing. How come you're not doing that thing?" I thought, "What? How come you're not going back for the second series? I thought you were doing the world tour." And I would like have to come up with these lies and these excuses, and then meanwhile carrying that deep shame and that deep embarrassment. And the only thing that could get rid of that was for me to, I needed like harder drugs. I needed like fucking stronger drugs. And that's when other types of drugs came in and other ways of taking them, and from then, like things like got like really messy really quickly. I ended up on the streets, like in my early 20s, homeless. And I remember like, I've got this memory of being in Manchester, and I've been begging all day in Manchester. I used to beg on Market Street in Manchester, and I got like, I don't know, I got a tenner together to go on score, or 20 quid or whatever. Jumped in a taxi, and it's all redeveloped now, but we'd go to like Colliehurst and Ancoats in Manchester, and that's where you'd go if you were in the north of Manchester. You'd go and score there, and I was in this taxi, and it was a wet, like a filthy, wet November night, throwing it down with rain, cold, and I'm in this taxi driving through Colliehurst, and on the radio, like the radio announcer go, "Now I've got the new single from da da da," and it was the band that I was working with, and it was the single that I'd been working on, and it had been released, and I was sat, like, freezing cold, homeless, in the back of this cab on my way to score, and I was listening on the radio to this band, and it was like, "Look what you could have won. Look what you could have won, Steve." And it was like, that's a point where I just kind of gave up. I just kind of thought, "Well, fuck this." Do you know what I mean? Like, you really can't fucking get it together, can you, Steve? You really, I mean, I started to believe that negative bullshit that my head told me. I started to believe the lies of the illness, and I really bought into those lies. So I just kind of think I just, and that was nowhere near my rock bottom, but I stayed in that place for a long time. And I'm gonna fast forward now, because then it was just like full blown active addiction. And for me, what that looked like, I guess that's different for all of us, but what me that looked for what that looked like was homelessness, hostels, crime, criminal records, probation courses. I avoided prison by the skin of my teeth. I was always really good in court. I could always I could always blag a judge. And it was just grim. It was just like, it was a world of violence, and kind of it was dark, man. It was dark. And I was completely freaking powerless. I didn't want to be in those places. I remember begging again in Manchester. Been, and it was at Christmas, and sat on Market Street outside the Boots on Market Street on this little bit of cardboard. You know, trying to get a few quid together to get a bag and withdrawing and kind of, and it was Christmas time and everyone was going past and all the Christmas lights were on and people were in their smart clothes and it was like about 6 o'clock and they were going to office parties and Christmas parties and they were carrying shopping bags and arm in arm and there were lovers and it was, everyone was really happy and I was sat there on this little bit of cardboard, like all hunched up, going, how the fuck do they do that? I just wanted to be part of that world, but I had no idea to get how to get there. How do they do that? I had no idea. And it felt like there was just this world that was completely excluded from me. And it just kind of like broke my heart. I just like there was, I look back at this time and it's just the overwhelming feeling that comes is this sadness that was in my, this pervasive sadness that was in my heart, this pervaded, this darkness that was in my heart constantly. And all I could do to get rid of this like deep emotional pain was to use more. And all the time I was just looking, I would just, so I could get that oblivion and just kind of like, so I could just lights out. Let me not feel this anymore. Let me not feel this pain anymore. Let me not feel this self-hatred anymore. Let me not feel this shame anymore. So I would, you know, I would burn, I'd wake up, my eyes would be open and bam, I'd be out the door. Very often I'd just be wearing the clothes that I'd fallen asleep and I wouldn't wash, wouldn't shower, bam, I'd be out the door. I'd be like shoplifting, that was my big thing. I was a pretty good shoplifter. So I'd go bam, I'd go out shoplifting and I'd shoplift meat and I'd get the meat together and then I'd go to the pubs and I'd sell the meat in the pubs and I'd get the money together and I'd go to the dealers and da 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 and it was just like this. And I'd do that like twice a day and that was like my life every day. I went to rehab in my 30s, but it wasn't really kind of like, you know, the social services paid for me to go to rehab, and it was like it wasn't a 12-step program, it was a therapeutic community. And I just blended in the background. You know, I just blended in. Please don't look at me. Don't ask me anything difficult. Don't ask me to change. Don't ask me to, because I knew how to fit in. Like I know how to fit in. So I just kind of like, I know what I can do here to fit in. I know what I have to do to make it look like I'm working a program. Not a program, you know, working you know, whatever was going on in the therapeutic community. I know what it looks like to make it look like, to make you think that I'm all right. And I was freaking using in the rehab, like, you know, after the 8 months in it, I went out and I freaking used. And I came back and got a slap on the wrist and blah, blah, blah. Then I left there and I had this period of 18 months after that, where I was clean, and I'm not going to go through my whole using history. I'm going to kind of, but I just want to, this is important. Like I had this 18 months, and in that 18 months, I was clean, but I didn't have a program. I'd left rehab. I was clean. I was in Liverpool, in this like flat in Liverpool. I was like studying at college. I was clean, and it was the most miserable 18 months of my life because I was obsessed with using every single freaking day. You know, every day I thought about using. Every day, I was obsessed with using, and I was just white knuckling it for 18 months until eventually, after I just crumbled and you know, I used again, and that relapse lasted me. That was like the first years I call it were my heroin years, and like the second, the next chunk of my using was like I call it like the stimulant years, like the coke and crack and stimulant years, and that's when things started really getting freaking funky, you know. And everything I kind of, you know, in that 18 months, I managed to build stuff up. I was kind of thing. I got in a relationship. You know, I got married a bit later, and I kept, when I relapsed, I kept it all secret for like a few years. I managed to keep it secret until, as it always does, it gets worse and the wheels come off. The money starts going missing. The behavior starts getting funky. I remember the week before I was due to get married to my now ex-wife, I had to tell her that the £20,000 that she thought we had in our account, you know, to pay for the wedding, like wasn't there because I'd spent it all on coke, you know. I had to tell her that, you know, and we had to, you know, this is the consequences of my, and I have to share about this stuff because this is where my using takes me. This is where my using takes, because it doesn't just, really, it's other people suffer more than me when I'm in active addiction. And that is why I'm so blessed, so grateful to be clean today. and not causing harm anymore today, not causing suffering anymore today. And I'll never forget the look on Joe's face when I told her that. You know, and we kind of got it together, we rallied around, we managed to scrape together, we had to make some changes. And you know, imagine the humiliation for her saying, oh well, we've got a different menu now and this, and it couldn't be the nice stuff for the wedding and blah blah blah, all these last minute changes. And I remember when we got into bed that night, we got married, and she was just like absolutely like her feeling like people should be happy on the wedding day, right? And joyful. But like she was like, thank fuck I got through that and held it together and didn't fucking lose my shit. You know. That's where my using takes me. And it got worse. You know, the marriage fell apart eventually. And fast forward to just before I came, you know, then I end up back on, then I'm back on the streets again, ripping off doctors, traveling around the UK. And in the last few years of my using, I was just like in a permanent state of psychosis. And I had this experience, I overdosed, and I'd overdosed many times before, but I had this experience, I collapsed on this public train, in this train toilet. I'd been up like 4 days, and at the end of my using, I was like injecting 70 times a day. None of this is really relevant, it's just kind of like, this is where my using takes me. Like, this is kind of like, this is why for me, like, the program and staying clean is like so important, because I know where I will go. I'm under no illusion. I will freaking use again. I will be back on Market Street begging within weeks, if not days, if I stop doing this stuff. And that's, thank God, the step work has shown me that. The step work has shown me the truth of what I suffer from and where my using takes me. So I was on this train, I collapsed in this train toilet, and I could feel the life ebbing from my body. I was laying there in this filthy train toilet, you know, covered in urine and soiled toilet paper, and lay on, and I could feel myself dying in this. I could feel life leaving my body. I could feel the breath of death on my neck. And I wasn't afraid. It would have been a relief, like, just to kind of like let go at that point, because like the internal unmanageability and the internal emotional pain was so great, like even the drugs couldn't even get rid of it at that point. And I just freaking had enough. Like, I couldn't do it anymore. And I could feel like the life leave me, and eventually, and that my kind of visions kind of closed in and faded, and eventually all I became conscious of, there was just this tiny little pinprick of light that was left. And I knew that that was the last bit of light in my soul, the last remaining bit of my life force. And I knew if that light went, like if that little pinprick of light went out, that was me gone. And in that moment, I cried out, and I don't know whether I said it out loud or said it in my head. I just said, God, I don't want to die. I want to live. Please help me. Please help me. And I kind of came to, I came to, I managed to kind of hold myself up to the toilet bowl, and I just leaned over that toilet bowl. And I just prayed. I just like poured my heart out, like in a way I'd like never done before. Like, and in the days and weeks following this event, something shifted. And I became aware of two things that I'd not been aware of before. Firstly, I saw that the common denominator in all the pain, all the chaos, all the suffering, all the drama in my life, and the life of those around me, the common denominator in all of that was me and my drug use. I was the problem. I was the freaking problem. And once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it. It was like the scales falling from my eyes, and I just saw it. There it was. It was me. I was the problem. It's me and my drug use. And I couldn't blame my parents anymore. I couldn't blame the bullies at school. I couldn't blame the police or probation or whoever. It was me. I was the freaking problem. And no one was going to come and do recovery for me. Like, if I was going to get clean, I had to do that. No one was, because I always wanted the easier, softer. I always wanted someone to come and wipe my ass. Do you know what I mean? I always wanted someone to come and do the hard work for me. And I realized that was never going to happen. That was not happening. If I wanted recovery, then I had to do it. I had to be the one that took the steps. I wasn't thinking, I don't mean 12 steps, because I wasn't really aware of them. I just mean like I had to do something. I had to put some action in. The second thing that I saw was that when I was on that train toilet, and it was a packed commuter train, and there's people stood outside, and like no one came in and helped me. Like, and why would they? It would have been, I was like some, you know, Jeans covered in blood and long hair, like foaming at the mouth. Why would anyone have come and helped me? The point is that I realized that was symbolic of where I was in my life, like completely alone, completely separated from God, from anyone that had ever loved me or showed me any kindness or compassion or concern. My family didn't want anything to do with me. My wife had divorced me. No one. I had no one. I had pushed my using had driven everyone away. My using had steamrolled through the lives of other people, and so people wanted nothing to do with me because I traumatize other people with my using. I traumatize other people with my using. And it was in this space, in this couple of days after this experience on the train, I saw this stuff, and I reached out for help to someone. I walked in off the streets to this place, and I was homeless. This was in Barrow-in-Furness, and I walked off the street, and the manager of this particular drug service, he kind of sat me down, and what I know now is what he did then is that he carried a message to me. And that guy, I'm still in touch with him. He doesn't do meetings anymore, but I'm still in touch with that guy. He's still clean. And this guy saved my life. And that night, he took me to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I've been clean ever since that meeting. That was on June the 2nd, 2017. And my clean date is June the 3rd. And I've not used since that first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I have to share this. If you're new to Narcotics Anonymous, if this is your first meeting, if you're counting days, if you're still using, I just need to let you know that you never have to use again. It's not everyone's experience in Narcotics Anonymous. We're a diverse fellowship with diverse experiences, but that is my experience. That is my experience, which at least shows you that it is possible. You don't have to use again. And all I've done is I kept coming back. And I could kind of stop the share now. I could kind of go, yeah, and I kept coming back and I'm still clean. And that could kind of like be the end of my share, because really that's it. It's as simple as that. But within that simplicity, there's a whole, there is a story, the story of my recovery. What a beautiful journey. What a beautiful journey. Gosh, how blessed we are to have this 12-step program in our lives. Yes, because we get to stay clean one day at a time, but also because we get to undergo these powerful journeys of transformation and growth. I came in these rooms. What was I like when I came in these rooms? What was I like in that first meeting? I was shaking, I was withdrawing, I was psychotic. I kind of sat in the corner of the meeting. I projected this force field, like, don't come close to me, don't come anywhere near me. And before the meeting, I was kind of sat there hunched over my seat, sweating and like nervous, and kind of like these waves and waves of kind of like, hot flushes and all that kind of druggy, kind of withdrawy kind of mess. Full of fear and anxiety. And I remember like sitting back, bent, literally bent double in my seat, and like glancing up before the meeting and seeing people laughing and smiling and hugging one another. And they seemed so at ease with themselves. And there was such joy and such light in that room. And I remember thinking, whatever these people have got, I want it. Whatever these people have got, I want this. How do they do this? How can they be so at ease with themselves? How can they be laughing and sat next to each other just chatting? I hadn't spoken to anyone for years. I just used on my own. The only people I spoke to were dealers, and that was just a few grunts and a few, sometimes didn't even speak at all. That was the extent of my human communication. Like our literature says, and my using had reduced me to that animal level. I'm just sat here at my desk in Rome, and I just looked to my right, and I just saw a picture of my mum and dad. And my mum and dad both died when I was in active addiction. They never got to see me clean, but I know that they're kind of like, I know they get to see me clean now. And I know how much joy that brings them wherever they are, you know, in heaven. That's what I believe. That's, you know, but I know that that's, you know, they're, you know, and I'm really happy they get to see me clean. And I'm glad, I'm so glad I didn't die a using addict. I'm so glad I didn't die a using addict. And that first meeting was so powerful to me. I was a bit like, you know, like a plant. You've got a plant, and the plant, you know, if you don't water it, it kind of wilts and it kind of flops over the side of the plant pot. That's what I was like in that first meeting. But in that first meeting, it was like I was watered. And I could feel, in that first meeting, I could feel the life flooding back into me. I could feel the life flooding back into my soul as addicts shared, and they shared about how they had used like I'd used and been where I had been, and yet they were clean today and had a new way of life today. And I could feel the life flooding back into me. And I received something in that first meeting that I had been looking for all my life. And you guys gave it to me. It was given to me at that first meeting. I was given the gift of hope. I was given the gift of hope. And I can connect with that gift right now. And how powerful that was for me. And I, for the first time, I thought, maybe it doesn't have to, maybe my life could be different. Maybe I could be clean. Maybe I could. I don't think I thought, could I have a new way of life? But I definitely was thinking, maybe I could be clean like these people were clean. And so I kept coming back, and I've kept coming back ever since. I've got everything wrong in this program apart from two things. I kept coming back, number one, and number two, I've not picked up. And you know, even if you pick up, just keep coming back. That's the essential one. Keep coming back. And you know, this program has been, you know, I got a sponsor. I got a couple of sponsors at first, like my first sponsor, and he was a great guy. And then he couldn't work with me anymore because his life circumstances changed. So I got this other sponsor, and that kind of, all right, didn't really work out. And then I got the sponsor I've got now. I was about 7 months clean. I got the sponsor I got now. And we've been working together ever since. And I could share for you an hour about my sponsor. Like, I really could. He's a quiet man. He's not like an NA, like, you know, professional kind of, you know, big hitter. I mean, he's got a lot of clean time. He's coming up for 30 years, but he's just a quiet, humble man, and that really appealed to me. And whenever he shared, I always listened. And whenever he shared, I always identified. And when he always carried a message, and I thought, you know what, that guy's got something that I cannot. I know he's got something. It was obvious that he had something. It was obvious that he understood these steps. It was obvious that the program was his life. And so I asked him to sponsor me, and we went out for a coffee, and he said, we sat there in the Sainsbury's in Lancaster, and we sat opposite each other on a table, and he said, "What are you willing to do for your recovery?" And I said, completely heartfelt, without missing a beat, I just went, "Anything." And he said, "Okay, I can help you then. You know, and if you're willing to follow these simple suggestions, you know, I can help you." And so we started meeting, and we would meet every Sunday at 10 o'clock. I would go to his flat in Lancaster, and we started going through the step working guide. And you know, it was difficult. It's hard work, you know, because I was looking at things I'd never looked at before. I remember being in his flat and sharing. And like, kind of, I was sharing some like my step one stuff, like some of the harms I'd caused in my recovery, the, you know, some of the few of the things I've mentioned tonight, and but I'd never shared it before. I'd never talked, and it just suddenly hit me. And I just said to him, I said, "I can't believe I did all this stuff." And he said to me, "Stephen, it's not that you did this stuff; it's that you became okay with it. You became okay with it." And that's what I'm like in active addiction. The abnormal becomes normal. I become okay with traumatizing people. I become okay with like hurting myself. I become okay with hurting other people. I become okay with it. So it was really difficult looking at this stuff, but I began to get a sense of this is, he always used to tell me, he goes, "Stephen, you're not a bad person trying to get good, you're a sick person trying to get well." So I began to identify as a sick addict, not as a failure, not as a fuck up, not as a piece of shit, not as all the labels that had been given to me in the past, but just as someone sick, someone with an illness. And whilst that illness, and whilst I'm not responsible for having that illness, becoming aware of it then makes me responsible for my recovery. And I took that really seriously. Do you know what I mean? I took that, I thought, I could really, I thought, okay, well, I can't change the past. I can't change what I've done. But what I can do is take full, like work this program to the best of my ability. And that's what I've kind of done. That's what I've tried to do by attending regular meetings, by continuing to work with my sponsor, by sponsoring other men, by being of service to Narcotics Anonymous, and by really working the steps. I've gone through the 12 steps and the step working guide. I've got a long amends list, and I'm probably about three quarters of the way through those amends. And just to let you know, just as a little, and I guess I'm, I don't know how much time have I got, Steve or Ellen, how much time have I got?
You're good, my friend. You got a 5 minutes, 10 minutes
5 minutes.
to
Okay,
go.
cool. I'll begin to kind of wind it down, and I guess I'll end with a little story that takes it back to the beginning, because I was gonna, I've got a long amends list, and the amends process has been really beautiful, and really all the steps have been freeing, and I've had, like our literature promised us, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of working these steps. That's my experience. And what that spiritual awakening is for me is I've connected to who I really am, who Stephen really is. And then the rest of my recovery has been getting to know that person and learning to accept him and love him and treasure him and nourish him and nurture him. And that's, that's what a beautiful journey. The amends process has been really beautiful to me. And, on my amends list, there was one amend that I was not willing to make. Because, Step eight asks us, we became willing to make, we made a list of all the people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I was willing to make amends to everyone on that list apart from this one person. And the person who I was not willing to make amends to was the guy the studio that I stole from, the stuff that I stole from. And the reason why I wasn't willing to make amends to him was I was kind of afraid, because this guy had some really like heavy connections in the underworld, kind of, and I was kind of like, I'm not sure how that would go if I kind of like made that amend. Like, I'm not sure exactly, So I wasn't willing. But my sponsor always says to me, he says, listen, Stephen, it's okay if you're not willing. But what you can do, the action that you must take if you find yourself unwilling is to pray for willingness. That's the action you can do. So I prayed for willingness. And for 2, 3 years, I prayed for willingness. And at the beginning of this year, 2024, I finally became willing to make amends to this person. So I worked with my sponsor. I worked out, I found a way to get in contact with him. I found out a company they had. I got an address for that company. And we decided the way I was going to do it, I was going to write a letter. And I had so much fear, because I knew that putting this stuff down and admitting what I'd done and what I'd stolen from him, I'm making myself both criminally liable, and, I'm also and liable to kind of whatever he might, whatever reaction he might have. But my sponsor always said, do you trust this process? Do you trust this power? Now, there are some people, it does say, it takes just, I need to, it's important with this step that we shouldn't do it if we're putting ourselves at risk. But truthfully, having really prayed, I knew that really I wasn't. And the only thing that was stopping me was my fear. That was what was stopping me, is my fear. And I wanted to be, I wanted freedom from it. So I wrote this guy a letter, worked with my sponsor. He kind of checked it out. And I remember even having written it, and then I even went to, as I couldn't even post it. I got to the post box once, and I said, I can't do it, I can't post it. Anyway, so I posted it and thought nothing of it. I thought, okay, well, I've done my bit now. I've done it, I've become willing, and I've made the amend. What happens next is kind of, I'm powerless over that, and it's kind of none of my business. Like, I've done my bit, I've showed my willingness to clear this wreck, and I've been willing to put right what is wrong. And then 3 weeks later, I woke up, and I put on this letter, and I sent it from Rome. I put on the letter how he could contact me, and 3 weeks later, I woke up and there was an email from him. And He basically said, "Listen, thank you for the letter." He said, it really helps explain things, I knew stuff was go we knew stuff was going missing, but we weren't quite sure what was going on, and so this really helps kind of explain things and helps me understand what was going on a bit more at that time. So thank you for that. And he said, yes, some of the equipment you stole really had like sentimental value, and was very valuable. And then he said, and I said something in the letter that that I was aware that my actions would affect him, and my sponsor told me to put this in, like acknowledge that how I'd behave would affect his trust in other people. And he said, yeah, you're right, it did affect how your behavior did affect how I trusted other people. And then he said, but you know what, I get it. He said, I'm an addict too, and I've been clean 20 years. And then he shared a bit of experience with him, and he said, I've never done what you're done, kind of making the amends, So he said, what you can do, and he made a suggestion for how I can repay it. And he said, he said, there's a charity that's important to me, and if you can make a donation, he said, I'll leave the amount up to you. So I've got a monthly, I've got a monthly direct debit to that charity that I make now. And at the end of his letter, he said, be at peace, blessings be upon you. And if you want tickets for a gig, let me know. And I share that, because I carried the fear and the weight of that for 30 years, the guilt and shame of that I carried for 30 years. When I was in the back of that taxi in Ancoats in Manchester, got to school, that crippled me. The weight and the guilt and the shame had crippled me to such an extent I never thought I could recover from it. I never thought I could make that amend. I never thought I could become responsible to that extent. And yet this program has given me the ability to do that. That's how free I am today. That's the level of free. When my sponsor said, like, how free do you want to be? Like, it's like, I want to be totally free. And if you're in this program and you're doubting whether it will work for you or whether, just I hope you can hear the message, because I'm trying to communicate that any addict can have this freedom, because I've had it, and I was like, I was on death's door, a hopeless addict. And if my life could be transformed to such an extent that I can make amends in this way, and that I can go on the incredible journey of healing and recovery that I've gone on, then you can too. Just like millions of other addicts throughout the world. I'm so grateful for all of you. Like I said at the beginning, if I had the ability to restore myself to sanity, I would have done it in the 27 years I was in active addiction. I didn't want to be in doing that stuff, and but I don't have that ability on my own. I can't do it. It's only with you guys. It's only listening to your experience. It's only through walking alongside you, doing meetings with you, being of service with you, sharing with you, that I get to recover. And for that, I am truly blessed and truly grateful. My name's Stephen, and I'm a grateful recovering addict. Thank you for letting me share.